This podcast is primarily recorded on the traditional territories of the Huron-Wendat and Haudenosaunee peoples, in Cataraqui, or Kingston by its colonial name. We center the rightful stewards of this land in order to unsettle our fight for collective liberation. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Queer Muslim Resistance, a podcast from Oakburg, Kingston. My name is Maha, and I'm one of your hosts. And today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Masuma, a queer Muslim based in Toronto, or Toronto and Mohawk. We have a conversation about her experiences navigating the world. Stay tuned. Hello.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for asking. I'm really excited to be here.
Awesome. Me too. I'm excited to have you here. So to get us started, would you mind answering the question of, well, it's the annoying question, the background question. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your name, your pronouns, your background, where you're based, and whatever else you'd like to share.
Yeah, so my name is Masuma. I use she and her pronouns. I am based in and reside in what is known as Toronto. I've been living here for about 20 years now. I moved from Pakistan when I was a child. Mm-hmm. My day job is working in the live entertainment industry. So that's kind of where I'm at, working in concerts and sporting events in Toronto. And I'm also a writer.
Awesome. How has the event industry been impacted by COVID?
As you can imagine, it's been... it's been one of the many industries where there's just a lot of question marks.
And it's
really interesting kind of hearing conversations about how the industry is going to adapt to a future, because it really is just a question of when that many people can all be in a space together again. And without that, it's funny. It's almost like little Frankenstein versions of a live event, you know, like everyone's in your cars, or like you're all distanced, and there's a magic about it that's kind of missing. So I'm excited for when, you know, we can have something that resembles an industry again. But at the same time, it's like, I mean, me personally, I feel conflicted in it. I'm in no rush to push to get back to industry. You know, that's not the priority right now.
Mm-hmm. And you're a writer. I really want to know more about that. How did you come to be a writer, and what do you write about?
Yeah, it's really pretty recently that I've started actually saying like, hey, I'm a writer, and having confidence in that and saying that. But I mean, I've been writing forever. I started writing as an outlet for myself when I was a kid, as most writers do. I was an only child. I still am. And living in Toronto and feeling kind of isolated, like I wrote as an outlet for myself and just kind of being alone all the time. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, you know, I would just write in marker in my, like, I had binders full of blank white pages, and I would just fill them with stories and like make my own zines when I was like 10 years old. And I found one fairly recently that was like, I had a hot or not section from when like 2000, and like what's hot is like Skechers and Good Charlotte, and like,
oh my god,
not, I literally wrote George W. Bush and racism. I was like, that shit holds up.
That's so funny. I love that.
But yeah, I've written a lot of different kinds of things and dabbled. I wrote mostly comedy for a while, so I did a lot of sketch comedy through university and stand-up comedy in the years after. Mm-hmm. And then I've been writing kind of personal essays, cultural criticism, that kind of stuff, more recently, and started a Substack during the pandemic, just awesome. As kind of an outlet for that. And I'm trying to build a portfolio and get into TV writing. That's kind of where I want to land. So
that's so awesome. Yeah. And comedy is such a, well, they're all very interesting forms, obviously, but comedy is such an interesting form, I think, because like, of the way people use humor to get through things, to challenge things, to talk about things that you don't normally talk about, or that you do, but to bring light to things. Like, what's your experience with comedy been like?
Honestly, very complicated. It's been a really complicated experience, and it's only more recently that I'm kind of getting back into writing comedy. Mm-hmm. I found it as an outlet to kind of, like you said, deal with some stuff about myself. And as while I was still learning about myself, that I was kind of getting up on stage and talking about it with a bunch of people. And it was interesting because I found that after a certain point, the stuff I was processing on stage, it didn't feel like it was for me anymore. Mm-hmm. And it didn't necessarily feel like the audience was the audience I was writing it for either. Mm-hmm. It was rare that there was people in the audience who could identify with, like, you know, me talking about my family and kind of aspects of my past. It was also a kind of way for me to process a breakup at the time. And I kind of go back and look at my comedy from then. And it was kind of like right as I was getting out of university that I was doing it. And it feels like I'm so removed from being that person. Mm-hmm. I actually wrote like the first essay that I got published. And it was my first, like, I feel like we all get one formative diaspora poem, like type essay, being mm-hmm. like, here's with my school lunches, let's get it out of the way. Let's talk about it. You know?
Yeah.
And that was the essay I wrote in 2015. And it was about why I stopped doing stand-up. And it was literally because it felt like I was othering myself more than anyone else could other me, just in what I was getting up on stage by saying, hey, I'm different. And it got to the point where I was like, I don't know if that's what I want to get up on stage and say anymore, you know? And it didn't have the right outlet for me to explore what I wanted to explore. And then I also just like wasn't laughing. I didn't find a lot of stuff I could, you know, find funny. And now I'm almost going back to writing comedy just because things just, I feel like I'm leaning hard into absurdism right now. Mm-hmm. That's what makes sense to me.
Yeah. Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
I've been asking myself lately what I want to write if it's just for me. And mm-hmm. I think that I get very bogged down by audience and by platform and by trying to cater my work towards, you know, where's it going to end up? Who's going to see it? What are they going to mm-hmm. think? And putting that before the work itself is so paralyzing.
Yeah.
And it doesn't serve the work. It doesn't serve the audience. It doesn't serve me. And so I struggled with that for a long time as well. And part of it was also just as a consumer, like what was I seeing, and what was the, like, what did I want to write that I wasn't seeing, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think that like weighing myself down with all those questions of representation and all those questions of like, am I writing something important? Am I writing something that's going to matter? Obviously we want our stories to be told and we want what we write to matter. But I think weighing that importance stopped me from just having fun writing.
Yeah.
Especially now more than ever, I feel like I'm appreciating like just silly sketch comedy and absurdist stuff that I, you know, stuff like The State and stuff like, you know, things that are not necessarily political commentary, but just mm-hmm. absurd, you know, like I Think You Should Leave with Tim Robinson on Netflix is something I saw recently that I was like, yeah, this makes no sense. And that's perfect. Cause like, mm-hmm. it feels like nothing makes sense these days. So leaning into that silliness and leaning into that absurdity, I think it also is freeing for me because it's, I'm writing and I'm expressing and it's not tied to what other people project onto me. It's not tied to my, you know, experiences. It's just funny. It's just silly. And that's enough sometimes, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like, I think that silliness is something that's so important in these times when like everything is so overwhelmingly bad, right? It's nice to just be able to, it's not just nice. It's peaceful. I don't know if peaceful is the right word, but you know what I mean. I'm sure
it is. It's allowing ourselves just space for joy or space for like something that doesn't need to be weighed with importance other than just it's a moment of experience. And I think so much of, you know, what we fight for and what we're striving towards is a future where we have more of those moments of just being silly and allowing mm-hmm. ourselves that joy. And I think I had that realization where I was like, if I'm stopping myself from feeling that, like I'm doing that to myself. There's so many things in this world that are going to stop you from having a good time. I don't want to be another one of them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes sense. I kind of want to find out more about your background. So what was your introduction to Islam like?
I grew up in a Shia household. Mm-hmm. So growing up with my family, it was interesting because moving to Canada when I was like 6 years old, I had family back in Pakistan, but we were pretty isolated when we came here. And so I never really grew up with much of a community or even very much family nearby. So it's just my parents mm-hmm. and I. And they didn't really practice, like, you know, we didn't participate in the ritual of Islam. And I had a pretty turbulent childhood moving around as a kid as well. So I think that it's something that was really important for my parents to pass on to me, but they didn't have like the time or the resources to really sit and impart wisdom or to teach me. So mm-hmm. it was kind of contentious growing up, because I think there was this expectation that's like, well, you're a Muslim girl in a Muslim household and this is how we act. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, but you're telling me that, but I don't really have a model for this. I don't have people I can talk to about this. And it was one of these things where especially my mother's faith is very important to her, but it's also very private and very personal. And that's something that I've really come to appreciate as I'm building my own relationship to my faith as an adult. Yeah. But at the time, it was one of those things that was really contentious towards us, because I'm like, you brought me here. I'm trying to fit into this environment. And it was almost like this expectation that I wanted to form a relationship with my mother outside of Islam, because I didn't really understand it or accept it. I saw it as more of like an imposition or something I was expected to follow. And it seemed like everything I did was wrong because it wasn't what was expected. And I think for my mother, my rejection of Islam was a barrier to her relationship with me. And it was almost like I wished I could have a relationship for her without it. And I resented the fact that I felt that I couldn't have one without that being a part of it. So it was very loaded for me growing up. And it wasn't until really a lot more recently and since kind of clocking in and realizing that I'm queer and realizing so many things about myself that I've kind of come back to it to form a new relationship to it on my own terms.
Yeah, I was just gonna ask, because you said that you felt this imposition of religion on you. How do you make sense of that now?
I get it now that I'm older. I've really been kind of going through it, thinking about the fact that, like, you know, I'm getting close to 30. I don't want to say I'm 30 yet. But thinking about how, and it trips me out when I think about this, but like, I am now the age that my mother was at when she was telling me these things and I didn't understand. And just realizing how, you know, young she was mm-hmm. at the time. And it's like, I get this fear of bringing your child to a new place and you feel like they're just so untethered from the expectations you had for them. Mm-hmm. And it really did feel like a tether to me. It was something that I felt that like was pulling me back from fully engaging in this world that I wanted to be a part of. And by that world, I don't know, North York, like I don't know what it is that I was so desperate to throw myself into, just high school in general. But it felt like my faith was, you know, I only ever really heard about it when I was doing something wrong and this is what I should be doing instead. Mm-hmm. Not, you know, the kind of lessons that are about what it would bring to my life. More so it felt like something that was restricted mm-hmm. to me.
Yeah.
Without that deeper understanding of Islam in general, but then also just, you know, as I'm growing older and learning more about it, I'll be the first to admit it's a journey, and calling myself, there was a while there where I would fight with my mom and I would say to her, like, I don't think I should call myself a Muslim because I don't think I am. And one of the things she said to me, we used to fight quite a lot when I was younger, when I was at my most quote unquote rebellious. And when I said, you know, I don't think I'm Muslim, she's like, then I don't think you're my daughter. And, you know, that's such a slap in the face, right? Because it's like, so that negates everything else about who I am. And, you know, you don't see yourself in me if you don't see that. Mm-hmm. But that's how important my mom's faith is to her. And I appreciate it in a new way now. At the time, I thought it was unreasonable. Because mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm here, I'm your daughter right in front of you. You know, I'm your flesh and blood. And I know that I'm flawed. But that's not all there is to me. And so that was really tough as a kid, because I only saw it as this thing that was a reminder of all the ways in which I didn't live up to an expectation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But like you said, this very interesting word, untethered, and that kind of reminds me of something that you've said to me previously. You once said that you fear you'll always feel like a rootless tree. What an interesting metaphor. I really want to unpack that a little bit.
Yeah, the tree metaphor, I started like thinking about just in terms of like, you know, where I'm coming from, but then also like one of my early bios that I would put when I was writing was that like I have my roots in Karachi, but my branches in Toronto. Mm. And I just like, that's the stuff that I'm made of. And there's so much of it that I don't know, and I don't necessarily feel a connection to. And that comes back to like my culture, a lot of my family. It's still a lot of question marks. Like, I haven't been back to Karachi since moving here. So it's been over 20 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've seen some family when they've come here, but it hasn't been that frequent. So I think just having that like kind of almost gap in a part of myself, that's the rootless aspect where I feel like, you know, I'm trying to build a future for myself here, and I'm trying to like establish myself in Toronto, but everything just feels very transitory, you know. I don't feel that rootedness in place, and feeling like, yeah, this is where I'm from, this is where I belong, you know.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that I am finding community, because that is such a common feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like growing up, it was one of those things that's like, well, I don't really belong here, and I don't really belong there, and so I don't really belong anywhere. And that's honestly like the first essay I wrote that got published, it was kind of that sentiment in which like we find belonging in the fact that we don't feel like we belong anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And especially like, you know, now finding community like this podcast and finding other people who are from the diaspora and, you know, have gone through similar things. It's like this feeling that I feel much more rooted by people than I do by place.
I love that a lot. I love that a lot. Like in my own work, for school, like I wrote a paper on like why we need to think of community, especially as us being situated on Turtle Island, like why we need to think of community as in a deterritorial and relational way, rather than like trying to establish a sense of self in relation to the land, by claiming that land is ours. And like by claiming like Canadianness or Americanness. So that kind of reminds me of the next question that I had for you. How do you think about the complicatedness of belonging as a queer Shia Muslim while being on stolen land?
Yeah. Belonging's a big word.
Yeah.
It's funny. Like I'm a notorious people pleaser.
Mm-hmm.
I can't stand the thought of someone not liking me. And that was huge for me growing up, you know,
but
not for my own family, just for people whose opinions I probably shouldn't care about. But those are the ones that I really wanted to win over. I think there's so many layers to that, because finding belonging as a queer person, finding belonging as a Muslim person, and just the multitude of experiences within those two umbrellas alone, let alone kind of being in Canada, and being in this environment where I grew up in pretty homogenous neighborhoods. Like there really weren't a lot of people that looked like me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very similar kind of like upper middle class, white, vibe.
Yeah.
And I feel like so much of me was shaped by that, in terms of my genuine interest, but then also like the parts of myself that I shaved away in order to feel included in the circle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been interesting because as I've grown up and I've kind of been in different environments, I've found myself like trying to mold myself to fit that environment. And it doesn't last long enough. You know what I mean? Like I did my first 6 years in one school, then I did middle school for 2 years, and that was a whole other district. And so those 2 years, I'm like, what happened there? I was 12 and 13 and I don't know who I was. But I think like, as I'm growing older and understanding more about the way our culture is shaped and who really feels like they belong, it's so silly to feel that I, like, none of us belong here except for the people that are Indigenous to here. Like, it's all so constructed, and it's all, you know, this feeling of, like, entitlement over the land and over the ways in which we're supposed to be doing things. Like, it's so arbitrary. And I can't believe I was so pressed to fit into that. But it's really complicated, and it does go back to kind of the last question in terms of like finding that community within other people who feel, you know, that displacement. Because I think displacement in general is a big theme, like diasporically within Indigenous communities, you know, even within families through queerness and how that displaces us and separates us. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of it, like, I came to realizations in waves. Like, first I kind of accepted my queerness, and then I was like, oh, I do identify as Muslim, I do have a relationship to Islam, and learning how to live on this land is a continuous process of learning and unlearning, questioning kind of what you're raised to believe. Mm-hmm. And it kind of comes down to just learning as much as I can and trusting that what I feel to be true in my heart about myself is ultimately what's true, and not what I'm worried other people will project onto me, especially like coming to Canada as a kid. I mean, there's a whole generation of us, like when 9/11 happened, like I was in grade, I don't know, 4 or 5. And so I think just like even the messaging and the media and everything and just the perception of Muslims and how much that changed, it made me feel like, oh, this is something I do not want to identify with.
Yeah.
And that's also just like a product of empire. That's mm-hmm. that's part, you know what I mean? Like it's funny, even not being in that part of the world, you're still so shaped by the Western relationship to that part of the world and feel like you have to disconnect yourself from that in order to be accepted here. I've just been trying to work on saying what I think is right and what I believe, and that's not aligning myself to any kind of one nationality or allegiance to that, because like you said, like it's the relationship to people and it's our communities, and it's not you know, we can't be so territorial about who deserves to be where. It's like, we're all here. What are we going to do to help each other?
So how are you able to start healing your ancestral and familial relationships? What role does embodying your faith and queerness play into this?
Yeah, the ancestral and familial relationships, I'm definitely still working on.
For sure.
As I'd mentioned, I kind of came to my queerness first before I came to my religion and my spirituality. And I think that was a kind of a product of understanding. I think I defined myself in opposition so much to what was expected of me by my family, by my parents, because I felt like it was a box I didn't fit in. And a lot of the fights that we'd have when I was a teen was kind of like, I was boy crazy, and I was like just trying to date white boys, and they're like, that's not what we do. I'm like, well, that's what we do here. I don't know about you, but that's what everyone's doing around me. So yeah. I think that's what I got to do. And it wasn't until I came out in my mid-20s. But a huge part of everything in healing my relationship to myself, to my family, all of it is questioning. Mm-hmm. And being okay with questioning and having space for that. And first it was questioning my relationships, questioning what and who made me happy and the spaces in which I felt safe and supported. And as I kind of came out, quote unquote, came out to myself at least, and realized that I was queer and had my first relationship, which is still my partner of several years. The first time I told my mom, that was a big step in our relationship. And it was also the kind of, it shifted our relationship in a sense, because suddenly she was learning from me. Mm-hmm. And I think that made our dialogue different. And it was almost like, it was so far removed from the expectation of me that it wasn't even that I was in defiance. It was just, I was playing a whole other game altogether. You know, I'm crafting this identity that's so far beyond even what they had thought, or expected, that it was almost like, okay, we're starting from zero. Who are we to each other? And how do we still have a relationship and love each other when we don't understand each other in the way that we thought that we would, or that, you know, we wanted to? And so in that, also questioning my faith. And then I think it was a a matter of my mom even questioning her own faith, right? In terms of her belief in the fact that she has a queer daughter, can she still practice her faith? Like, how does that impact what she's been, you know, taught to believe, or what she believes is, you know, and fundamentally right or wrong? So I think space for her to question that, space for me to question myself, and then space for me to question religion and question Islam and kind of realize I came to it. A lot of the time within my family, at least growing up, it was almost like we became more religious during the holy periods. You know what I mean? Like, we don't eat pork, but we keep halal. Vice versa. We don't keep halal, but we don't eat pork either. You know, and it was always just this series of compromises that you have to make in order to adapt to the environments that you're in and be able to sustain a life as best as possible, right? It was like, you know, we wouldn't really talk about religion very much in the house, but then it was Muharram. And, you know, as a Shia family, it was like, okay, well, now we're not going to listen to music and we're going to wear all black. And this is a period where we're supposed to be sad for 40 days. And that was the extent to which I understood it as a kid. And growing up and kind of really understanding what ritual means, why we're doing this, what is the significance, and really the storytelling, you know, as a writer, as a storyteller, understanding that these were people and these are stories, and, you know, I don't need to necessarily buy in 100% to everything, but I can understand it in my own way and approach it in my own way. And realizing that my faith is a relationship that I have alone, you know, with my creator, and that's not anyone else to define but myself. So that's been really healing for me, because it took away some of that shame. I think the shame is the biggest thing that stopped me from making those connections with family and with embracing that part of myself, because I'm realizing it doesn't have to be at odds. And if I'm having these realizations, you know, at my big, big age in the year 2020, like, how many of my ancestors have gone through,
you know? Right? Yeah.
I can't be the first one. And there's comfort in that as well.
I love that a lot. What does collective healing mean to you?
Collective healing means a lot of things based on who the collective is. I think collective healing in a broad scale is redefining our relationships to our priorities and what's important, starting with sustainability and land. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Until we kind of get that sorted, nothing else will fall into place. I think it's been frustrating for me in an industry, and I think in many industries where we're having conversations about diversity and inclusion, that I feel like these are conversations we should have been having so much longer ago. Like, what are we doing at this point? And when we talk about what kind of future we want to build, like, I feel like so much work that I see done is just trying to undo harm. And it's not trying to build on what you want as an alternative. Mm-hmm. And if we're not thinking about what the alternative is that we want to build, then we're only doing half the work, and it's not going to be sustainable. It's not going to take us into a future where people are cared for. You know, collective healing to me is Indigenous sovereignty. It's, having a real social safety net, and not just minimum wage, you know, but having there be a responsibility to take care of people that's taken seriously. And that's just not left up to, well, if you feel like it, you can give your money to someone. It's, and the sharing of resources and realizing that we're in this together, and we only have each other at the end of the day. It's just each other and the world we've been given. And that's all we got. And so that's been huge. And that's kind of what I think when I think long-term collective healing is, being in a space where we prioritize that as a collective, and having that freedom to dream, free from that, you know, that trauma that stops us from imagining something better for ourselves or for our communities, because we're so used to fighting against what doesn't work. So having that space to imagine that and to dream for it, and allowing ourselves that joy, allowing ourselves community and making connections and, holding on to what is ours, what can't be taken away, you know, what can't be, what can't be changed by force.
So how do you manifest or practice towards queer Muslim futures in your daily life?
You know, I've honestly recently gotten into what manifesting is all about. Like, I've heard it used so often, but it's so much in this context of like, well, if you want it, it's going to happen. And I was like, I don't buy into that. I started listening to a podcast recently that was about manifesting, and it was like this this Australian lady talking about, you know, energy, and she kept saying, you know, manifesting's not some woo-woo thing that you, that's my Australian accent. And I was kind of listening, being like, okay, I'll see what I can take from this, and like, what, you know, I take some of it, leave the rest. But honestly, like, I buy into energy, I buy into a mindset and a framework, and kind of putting your energy into believing that something will be better and working towards what you want to see. And so for me, you know, queer Muslim futures, it's part of collective healing, and it's a future in which, you know, being queer and being Muslim is not necessarily seen as something that's so marginalized. It's just a facet of experience. Even in, you know, talking to people in my circle, and I, you know, mentioned that I was going to be doing this podcast, and someone I worked with was like, wow, like, you're the only one I know. I'm like, yeah, I know, but like,
there's so many of us.
So many of us. And yeah, there's so many ways to be queer, and there's so many ways to practice Islam. And just the umbrella, you know, of being seen as a queer Muslim, it's just such like, whoa. But I was like, we're just people. But I, you know, but you don't realize how radical existence is. I think I take that for granted. I take for granted that my story is unique. I take for granted that my experience is unique, and that I have these perspectives that others don't, because it's just how I've always moved through the world. You know, it's just who I am. But part of, you know, practicing queer Muslim futures is just living out loud and, you know, being open about my journey, about my relationships, about my queer relationships, about my familial relationships, about the ways in which they do and they don't support each other sometimes, or, you know, what I can learn about them through understanding them. Even as a writer, when I think about like representation of queer stories, I think of representation of Muslim stories, how we've been shown so little of what's possible. And just in our lives and in our conversations, we know the multiplicity of experiences that we could be seeing as models, and we don't have that. So part of my, you know, practicing towards that future is writing it so that people can see it, and so that there's, you know, a kid out there like me who doesn't think that in order to be a teen, she has to fit into a certain mold, you know? So just living and existing is radical in and of itself.
Yeah, I love that. Before we go, is there anything that you'd like the listeners to take away from your experiences and your stories?
I mean, if you take something away from it, that's great. I living is radical. So even if what you take from this is that there's no one way that you need to live your life or to practice it, for me, it's this constant state of reinventing, honestly, and relearning stuff about myself, and realizing that the way I operate is not linear, and the path that I've taken is not linear. I've had so many experiences, and, you know, I look back on some things that I did for like a year or two, and I was like, I was in collegiate a cappella, like touring upstate New York, like what? And I was right around Pitch Perfect, so I was like, that's the life I lived. You know, all those aspects. But just that there's no wrong way to live. I still question that and challenge myself when I think of the ways in which I feel like I'm letting myself down sometimes. You know, I have one living grandparent, and there's still a barrier between her and I where I feel like I don't feel comfortable disclosing like my living situation with her, that I live with my partner. and it's complicated. And I don't know if I'm not telling her for her sake or for mine. I really don't know who I'm protecting in that situation. But I know that I, you know, hopefully I will be able to in my own time and in my own way. And that's what's important. Like, you know, people can't force you to identify or disclose or something. Like, there's no pressure to define yourself in a certain way. It's a constant experience and constant state of understanding your relationship to queerness, to Islam, to the environments in which you operate. And it's always shifting. You know, we're always shifting.
Mm-hmm. I love that, like, giving space to people, or like for ourselves, for everyone around us to be able to grow. Just like that idea of letting growth happen when it needs to, if it needs to, how it needs to.
Exactly. I think especially we get fixated on this, like, there has to be this path, right? And if you're not at this point on this path, then it's seen as, you know, you internalize that failure. And it's been huge for me just to be like, there's no path other than the one that we're on, and we're constantly learning more about ourselves and about each other, and that's the only way that we grow and evolve in general, you know, not just individually but as a collective.
Yeah. Is there anything that you would like to plug, or where can folks find you?
You can find me at Gemini Holograms on most platforms, mostly on Instagram, a little bit on Twitter. That's Gemini, like the star sign, Holograms. And I also have a Substack under the same name, which you can find through my social media profiles. And that's where I kind of write a lot of my stuff right now. And I share my work.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much for having me. I feel like time flew by.
It really did. Hello, Taylor, and hello, Nicole.
Hi. Hey.
So the first thing that I wanted to talk about a little bit was how Masuma talked about finding joy in silliness through absurdist comedy specifically, because nothing makes sense, so why not just fuck around? And so I kind of want to expand that a little bit to, like, everything is overwhelming, so why not center our joy?
When she made the silliness comment, it, like, obviously she was talking to you, so I was thinking of you, but automatically I was like, Maha's gonna love that. Maha loves being silly. She's going to be like, I relate to this so much. Why not? I thought it was really sweet.
I think, yeah, centering joy as, and it's so interesting, the idea of absurdity. Because for me, absurdity, when I think about absurdity, it is not innately pleasurable
or joyful.
Yeah, like, it's something that is actually frustrating. I think that's the first emotion that comes to mind. And so to take that and sort of flip it on its head and find, well, in Masuma's case, comedy, but just joy and making yourself laugh and enjoying life even despite and because of the absurdity. I think, I don't know how to do that shit. I just get too pissed off. I don't know.
Me too. But it's a talent.
Yeah.
So one thing that I really liked that Masuma was talking about was being okay with questioning and having space for that. Because, I mean, I literally tattooed a question mark on my fucking wrist, but like, very specifically, because I think that you always have to question things around you and who you are, because I really truly think that if you're not questioning, like, your beliefs, your relationships, like, not questioning the relationships, but questioning what you want from relationships, questioning, like, your relationship with God, or what you want from your relationship with God, and what that means, and, like, what the divine means, and, like, literally just questioning everything, I think that you're not giving, like, yourself enough credit, and you should always be questioning who you are, and finding space in that, because you can find yourself in that, and being comfortable with that. Like, I'm not saying that you, like, are always questioning absolutely everything. I just mean, like, question things and also be comfortable in the answers you find by giving yourself that space. Does that make sense?
And also comfort in the not finding out of questions. Comfort in uncertainty, comfort in recognizing that we can't know everything, and that's okay.
Yes.
And it's so interesting because this was one of the points that I had written that I wanted to talk about. Oh, yeah. And I wanted to kind of talk more about like how we not only have to try and allow space for questioning, but allowing room for growth as well when we do this work. Especially like when we are confronting our parents with the realities of colonialism and queerness through our queer Muslimness, if that's something that you want to be doing. Existing, even though we're impossible, is confronting to all the internalized shit that our families hold and that we hold and are healing from. So it's important to allow space for unlearning toxic shit and healing, and to relearn how to best communicate with and love each other as queer and Muslim to whatever capacities we choose to disclose and share things with our families, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And even Masuma actually talked about that, because I have that as a note where it literally says giving space for everyone to grow. Mm-hmm. So absolutely. And it was something that she had said about when she came out to her mom, which I guess like I should have known is maybe a thought for religious parents, but I've never thought about it because, no offense to religious parents, but like I've literally never thought about how it affects them at all, because I'm like, just let your children be humans, thanks. But anywho, was when she said that she was talking to her mom and her mom started questioning her own faith and if she could still be Muslim because her daughter, and I might be getting Masuma's words wrong, so I'm just paraphrasing, but like her daughter was like that changes what she believes is fundamentally right or wrong. Mm-hmm. And then she was like then questioning if she could have a relationship with God and what that meant for her religion. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting because she's also, from what I could tell from the conversation, given her mom that time to grow. Mm-hmm. And that is something that I think is really, that takes a lot of strength. I could not do that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I've also never thought about that, and I was wondering what you thought.
Yeah, like for me that's been a huge part of why I was figuring out whether or not to tell my parents. That was something I was, well, not specifically the faith question, but I knew that they would question or start to question everything about themselves and everything about me, everything that they know. Or I'd hope that they would. I hope that they would start to question, because it's through the questioning that we're able to figure out not what's necessarily right and wrong, because that's not the goal here, but to figure out the realities of oppression and of structures of violence that have forced or that I've constructed, and I've mentioned this text earlier in the podcast as well, but Gayatri Gopinath talks about impossibility, about specifically about queer South Asian femmes being impossible within heteropatriarchal constructions of belonging through nation state formations. Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by impossible?
Impossible in the sense that if you're a woman, you are straight, because you represent the straight nation, and the straight nation produces straight babies for the progress of the nation. And the family is like, family is a site of globalization and capitalism. Mm-hmm. Family is a site in which,
well, it's like heteronationalism in the nuclear family, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if heteronationalism is a word, but there we go.
But it kind of sounds like a thing. It sounds like a thing, something it, works, so.
What you were just saying made me kind of think like, yeah, absolutely, because I think you see that in a lot of spaces. It made me think about when Masuma was saying like, you don't realize how radical your existence is. Mm-hmm. And like, just talking about like questioning everything about you, right? Because I think that's all tied in.
I was just going to say that I think just thinking about my own research and coming back to everything that we have talked about in terms of questioning and relationality and relationships, I think having relationships with people and making those relationships strong and important brings way or allows spaces of questioning to develop in ways that are so unexpected, because you are most challenged by the people you love. You are most challenged when you love, I think, period. So when you show love, and with that comes respect and understanding, or wanting to understand, or an empathy and compassion, all of that comes with love and loving another human being as a human being, and also developing strong relationships based on love. And so I think that's, you know, it makes sense to me that questioning in terms of religious beliefs, or also your relationships to other people and how that affects your understanding to your faith, is so central. It's so central, because the people closest to us, I think, challenge us the most, like, to be better people. And if you are so grounded in a faith that is, that promises love and encourages loving relationships, you can't escape it. Right? Like, you, to escape it is to escape the faith, to move away from relationality, but loving a human as a human is to be firm in your own beliefs and in your own thinking, and never, ever, 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 ever think about anybody else and their life. It's only to think about yourself. It is the most, in my opinion, narcissistic form, right? To say, I know everything. I don't ever need to ask any questions. It is the most narcissistic form. And we've identified that in all of our discussions, because we value people and we value community and learning from others. So,
and when you say that, Taylor, when you say, like, you know, if you don't question anything, you're literally, like, you're essentially, in my opinion, you're kind of conflating yourself to, like, the idea of the divine, because the divine is all knowing and, like, mm-hmm. you know mm-hmm. what I mean? So I think it becomes really toxic, and we know this. Something that I really liked that Masuma was talking about was long-term collective healing is actually starting to build the futures that we imagine, because right now shit is so fucked up that collective healing is just healing from trauma and not the ability right now. It feels like we don't have the ability to actually project the futures that we want for ourselves. That was my understanding, and I thought that was really important to talk about.
Can you just quickly repeat that, just so I'm like...
Yeah. So I think I wrote it. So it was a really long conversation, so I just want to make sure that, like, basically what I understood from what Masuma was saying was, like, collective healing right now is working on trauma and trauma healing, and, like, prioritizing that and understanding the freedom to dream, but kind of feeling like you can't, because right now you have to work on, like, dealing with the traumas, whereas long-term collective healing is actually not just being aware of the ability to dream those futures, but actually dreaming them and, like, dreaming them into existence and building them. That was my understanding.
That's so interesting, because I didn't see it as necessarily separate things. Like, I saw healing trauma as, like, I don't think healing trauma is a short-term goal.
I don't think so either, mm-hmm. but...
Yeah, no, for sure. But, like, I feel like healing trauma is how we build our futures. I feel like healing trauma is a process of dreaming that you can be better, dreaming that you can feel better, dreaming that you can exist in a world without all this fucked up shit.
Trauma.
Without trauma, yeah.
And we know that it's a part of the human experience. So it's not to say a world without pain, mm-hmm. but the idea of trauma as a lasting wound that is, you know, psychological and in your conscious almost, mm-hmm. that is an effect deeper than, you know, pain, the pain, how we understand pain, and more refers to, in my opinion, and perhaps Maha, this is what you were referring to as well, long-term, past, future, present, all of that time and space that we understand that we also take place, that also takes place when we our future dreaming, like dreaming of our futures. Mm-hmm. And which is why I think trauma and the idea of healing trauma, it's never fully finished, because mm-hmm. it's always past, present, and future based. We can anticipate trauma as an aspect of the human experience, but also work to prevent it and work.
It will continue to exist, but you can like know how to process.
Yes, and also to trauma is a result of society's failings. Mm. It's not a personal, it's not because of personal failures on behalf of an individual. Mm-hmm. So if we are working to build just futures, then trauma wouldn't be something exactly. that we have to process.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that's why it's important to differentiate trauma from pain and like injury. Mm-hmm. Because you can heal from injury, but trauma is something that takes, you can heal from trauma, but it is
a lot of work.
It's extended. And to think of that extension is to say who else, you know, what else affects my trauma, you know, and what other healing, what kind of healing justice do we need to have in place for people experiencing trauma?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for bringing that up, Nicole, because I didn't even think about talking about that. So yeah, thank you. So something else that I took from this conversation is that we can reframe faith as being something generative rather than something degrading. Like Masuma mentions faith as being a relationship with the creator, and we've already talked about how everything is relational, and relationships take work, right? And when you put in the work to be faith, when you put in that work, then you experience a sense of groundedness, a sense of ease of mind, whatever else people get from spirituality and faith, because I'm still trying to internalize the fact that I can access faith and that it can be something for me, because I've been so displaced from it through my queerness, and I'm trying to get it back. But that kind of brings me to talking about displacement.
Maha, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. Just before we get to displacement, I was just gonna say that I felt super, triggered when Masuma was saying that faith, like her relationship with Islam, was very much based on things that you don't do. And and for me, the first thing that came to mind was guilt.
Yeah.
And like Catholic guilt. And you should feel bad about all of this shit. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't really feel bad though. So, you know, and instead of feeling bad, it's more like feeling bad, you don't feel bad. Thinking of all of the people and all of the reasons why you should feel bad and yet you don't feel bad. So that's what that brought me right back.
Interesting, because I definitely have those thoughts, but they're still so internalized within me that I'm like, I guess I shouldn't be doing this. And then I'm like, Mama, find joy in however else you need to find joy. Like, let's stop with the shitty rules. But yeah, going back to displacement, like Masuma said, it's a product of empire. And this operates both like within ourselves internally, or this operates within people internally. So ourselves and our families or the people that we love in whatever capacity, anyways. So like we talked about, or Masuma mentioned, internalized Islamophobia as being something that she had to grapple with. So that's like displacement from the self, and like internalized anti-queerness as an imposition of like European binary constructions of gender and sexuality. So there's something so wonderful about working with the people that we love to transform beyond these relationships, into and through love. Like you and your grandma, for example, Taylor.
Right.
But before I ask you to talk about that, quickly going back to the concept of relationships and relationality, Masuma also talked about learning through relationships that we have with people. So in the context of like learning through and from and with parents and family, in terms of the specific context I'm talking about is in terms of acceptance and love as us being queer Muslims. So I thought this would be an interesting opportunity for you, Taylor, to talk about a little bit about your research on erotic pedagogy specifically.
I mean, I guess we talked about it earlier and continue to talk about it in the aspect of loving relationships, mm-hmm. and valuing those loving relationships as important learning spaces. So every time we talk about, for example, questioning and the value of family and just relationships, like I can't just say family because mm-hmm. it's developing strong relationships with people enough to be able to trust them enough to question yourself and to mm-hmm. and to ask questions of yourself and of them and hope that they will be honest and trust you enough to be honest and be vulnerable with you. And that's hard shit. Like, but, and I think, and that's a beautiful thing. Masuma writes and comedy and all of the different forms of production in that takes place in trying to make sense of that is so important, because oftentimes the people that we love, you know, we're all human, we're all fallible. And so they're not always going to be open, honest, 100% with you. Maybe they're not even going to say the things that you want to say. Like my grandmother, she doesn't always say the things that I want to say. And she frequently says things
that you want to hear her say.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And she frequently says things I don't necessarily want to hear her say. Mm-hmm. However, I think we can have conversation and we can, and I choose to ponder and question our relationship through, thankfully I've been able to do that through my work, through writing. It can be through performance pieces, through poetry, which I know that you, Maha, do a lot. You write a lot of poetry to make sense of these questions. And it's, so yeah, it's our relationships with people, but sometimes it doesn't mean like you know, those relationships with people are easy and, mm-hmm. you know, simple teacher, student, peer, mentor type relationship, mm-hmm. where you can get somebody who will just guide you along the way. Usually that shit does not happen. Usually you're sort of piecing along yourself through other people, but in that frequently creation and art and creativity and imagination and dreaming blooms from those spaces, because we have to fill in that gap. We use our relationships with others as a springboard for that learning. And that's what I'm really interested in. So,
yeah, I think I want also you to talk or tell the listeners about like the importance of the encounter, the erotic encounter. Mm. We talked about Audre Lorde's The Erotic but in a few episodes ago. Mm. But specifically, erotic pedagogy. What's pedagogy? What's erotic about that? Mm.
So I guess the idea of erotic pedagogy for me is a couple things. So the primary thing is sharing and doing that work of sharing in terms of asking questions and teaching and learning and engaging with other people. That all counts as sharing. So dialogue, work, you know, that is meaningful to you. And I think the encounter matters most primarily because it is a space for you to share, for you to learn, for you to teach, for you to engage, for you to ask questions. And that space, that when I say the encounter, or when I talk about the erotic encounter, really it's relationships. Like that's all we're talking about. It's being able to build a relationship, even if it is brief, with somebody in a way that is meaningful to both people. And it doesn't, the idea of work, learning and teaching, it doesn't have to happen in the moment. You're not gonna, you don't have to question somebody and get all the answers. That, it doesn't happen that way most of the time. Most of the time you have to do that reflective work. You have to go back and try to think and create. And that's where poetry comes from, music comes from, writing comes from, comedy comes from. You know, like, when we think of our arts, we think of our deepest emotions, and I think that stems from our relationships with people, and primarily loving, caring relationships with people. So yeah, I guess that's what I think about when I think of erotic pedagogies. And Masuma talks about all of this stuff informally when she talks about her relationship with her parents. She talks about how, you know, faith, and her mother specifically saying, you know, when Masuma was a teen or younger person and said, you know, I don't know if I'm Muslim, and her mother said, well, if you're not Muslim, I don't know if you could be my daughter. Mm-hmm. And like that shit hurts, you know, like, it's like, ooh, sting, like, ouch, it hurts. But it also offers, because that relationship didn't fail, because it continued to be one of, hopefully, now, we don't know Masuma's real life and her personal business. We going off of the interview. But based off the interview, the relationship continues, and hopefully, and I believe, was a learning and continues to be a learning encounter, not because one person was able to teach another person something, but actually because people were able to question and question for themselves because of somebody else. So,
yeah. I think it's important to note that, like, it's okay. It's not okay to be hurt, but, like, it does happen in relationships. Like, one of the things that, like, I really, really think is, like, no matter what your relationship is with somebody, like, you might get hurt. You have no way of knowing that, but it's the growth that comes from getting hurt, too. Because it's hard. Like, when you get hurt, it's easier to think to just cut something off.
Yep. So it's giving space for growth, as Masuma mentioned. Yeah.
And not, like, also just not assuming other people's emotions.
Communication is key.
It's hard.
And it's hard as fuck.
Oh yeah. Communication, expectations, and boundaries. The hardest three fucking words, but also the most important. I really liked that Masuma was like, the thing about my writing is, like, the second I think about writing, essentially it's queer and it's Muslim. And that's nice to know that that's going to be there, because she's writing it. It's going to be out there for people.
Existence, right? Like, just being and choosing to be and continuing to, in being, continuing to question and defend your being, and your values, et cetera. I think, yeah, that's some important shit.
I guess, Maha, like, you probably think about this a lot because this is your research and stuff, but, like, when Masuma was, like, you know, sometimes you don't realize that your existence, like, who you are as a person is radical. Because you're just a person. Like, you're literally just you going through your daily life being you. And it's hard to sometimes, like, conceptualize that that is considered to be radical or, like, yeah, just, like, wild.
I'm just thinking about that.
I just didn't know if it was something you related to or because you study it. So.
Yeah. I think our existence is radical because of how, like I mentioned, impossibility earlier. When you're constructed to not be able to exist, and then you do exist, that's radical. Yeah.
Exactly. When you were talking about it earlier, I think I, like, vaguely mentioned it, but this is exactly what I thought about.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Queer Muslim Resistance. As always, you can find relevant links in the episode description. Make sure to check us out on Instagram for links to our Queer Muslim resource guide, to Tarif, a Queer Muslim reading group, and for awesome Queer Muslim content in general. You can email us at queermuslimresistance@gmail.com for any inquiries, additional resources you'd like to see added to the resource guide, or just say hi.